Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Today we're going to broadcast a speech that took place at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe on June 9th by former U.S. Attorney David Iglesias, author of the book Injustice, Inside the Scandal That Rocked the Bush Administration. He is joined in the question and answer section by former Ambassador Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame Wilson, former CIA operations officer, with yours truly asking the questions. David Iglesias will be speaking this Friday, September 12th, at 7 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe in a lecture titled Stepping Across the Party Line. The lecture is free, and it's the first of this year's Beyond the Lecture series.
I'll take just a few minutes, 15, maybe 20 tops, just to give you an overview of what I call the Justice Department scandal. The media calls it the U.S. Attorney scandal, but as I see it, my colleagues and I spoke out. What we did is not a scandal. What the Justice Department and the administration did is the scandal. So 3 points. Point number one is, ladies and gentlemen, this matter, like the Wilson and Plame matter, is not over. It's not on the front pages like it was, but there are still 5 pending investigations into this matter, which is unprecedented in American history. Don't let people rewrite history by telling you, oh, presidents fire U.S. attorneys all the time, they're just political appointees, because no president has ever fired 8 of his own people during his administration for any reason, much less a suspect political reason. In fact, the figure that I saw from the Congressional Research Office indicates that between 1981 and 2006, that's a 25-year period, 8 U.S. attorneys were fired for misconduct. Let me give you an example of the misconduct. A U.S. attorney in Florida lost a big case and was angry. He went to a strip club and bit the leg of a stripper. I'd call that misconduct. Another U.S. attorney, I'm not picking on Florida because I love to visit Florida, but another U.S. attorney in Tampa was upset at a trial, and I've actually seen this video because I got it from his successor. He grabbed the necktie of a reporter that was asking him a tough question. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's called assault and battery. So he was fired. So those are just 2 examples of misconduct. So it's not over, point number one. Number two, it's not about losing my job. I'm not suing to get my job back. My colleagues don't want their jobs back. It's about the principle of separation of powers and the crucial independence of having independent prosecutors, especially United States attorneys. Because remember, of all the political appointees out there, we're the only ones that can take away your life, your liberty, and your property. And you have the right, regardless of your political beliefs, to know that when you're charged with a crime, it's based on 2 things, the evidence and the law. There's no third component, such as politics, that will never enter into that equation in this country. So the scandal goes to the heart, the very heart of the American criminal justice system. The scandal is about ensuring the rule of the law in all 93 districts. Last week, I was privileged to join in an amicus brief. That's a friend of the court brief that the House of Representatives has filed. 25 former U.S. attorneys, Democrats, Republicans, in every administration going back to LBJ, with the exception of Gerald Ford. And I think because he was in for such a short amount of time, he didn't get to appoint very many U.S. attorneys. But 25 of us filed a friend of the court brief to argue in front of the federal court that this issue of executive privilege is one that has to be addressed. And we're hopeful that this judge, who is known to subscribe to the judicial abstention theory, which means I'm not sure this is really a matter for the courts to decide. In this case, when you've got 2 branches of government doing this, the executive and the legislative branch, there's only one possible place it can get resolved, and that's in the courts. So we're hopeful by showing that amount of bipartisan support that this is not a partisan issue. We're also joined by the Rutherford Institution, a very conservative institute, the Brennan Institute from New York, it's a liberal institute. They joined us. So again, this is not a partisan issue. This is a matter, as I said, that is ongoing. Justice is blind to politics, and my comments tonight are neither liberal or conservative, neither Republican or Democrat. This, ladies and gentlemen, is a matter of right and wrong, not a matter of right or left. So you may ask, how did this book come about? Well, a friend of mine who's a syndicated columnist named Ruben Navarrete, he writes for the San Diego Union-Trib. You've probably seen his piece in your hometown newspaper, called me back in March after my testimony in front of the House and Senate and said, you've got a great story. You really need to think about writing a book. And I had thought for a number of years, maybe I should write a book. But I thought, you know, that's pretty presumptuous of me because I don't have anything that important to say. So be careful what you ask for, because in 2007, that changed. So he provided me with his agent's name. I was contacted by some other agents, and the rest is history. I went to New York City last summer for some interviews with some publishers, and it really hit me at that point the magnitude of this scandal when my taxi driver said, oh, I know you. You're from New Mexico. You're that Iglesias guy. And then he proceeded to tell me all the great reasons why politics should never get involved in the prosecution process. And then just last week in D.C., I did a signing in Washington. I have another taxi story, another taxi driver. He saw a book that I was looking at, and we started chatting. He goes, oh, I know who you are. And this gentleman was from Senegal. And he understood the issues, too. So that was really gratifying to me that you had people that understood what's at stake here. And again, it's about the independence of prosecutors. Wiley's been fabulous. I had 4 months to write a book of 85,000 words, and I got about a couple thousand words into it, and I needed help. So I had a friend recommend a gentleman from California named Davin C., who really helped. And Cindy and my wife, who's here tonight, we interviewed Davin, great interview. And then after we decided on writing the book, lots of things happened. I'll just give you a real thumbnail sketch. Senate Ethics sent interviewers out to Albuquerque in March of 07. I was contacted by the Office of Special Counsel in April and asked to file a complaint against the Justice Department, which I did. I was interviewed by the Justice Department's Inspector General's office in June of last year. Now, they're tasked with seeing if criminal laws, not civil laws, but criminal laws, are broken by Justice Department personnel. In August of last year, I returned to Capitol Hill and testified before the House Ethics Committee. I went to this little room about the size of a broom closet way down in the bowels of the Capitol, and I testified. The chair told me I couldn't discuss my testimony, so to quote Forrest Gump, that's all I can say about that. All the meanwhile, in the spring and summer, Department of Justice officials were resigning in droves. Kyle Sampson, the chief of staff to former Attorney General Gonzalez, resigned. Monica Goodling resigned. She was the White House liaison and the counselor to the Attorney General. She has the dubious distinction of being the first Justice Department official to ever claim the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination before testifying in front of Congress. How'd you like that on your gravestone? The Deputy Attorney General, Paul McNulty, resigned. It was his claim of our alleged performance-related problems what triggered my colleagues and I to speak out. Because you know what? In this country, they can fire you, but they can't slander you. And he knew better. He knew that my colleagues and I were doing a good job. He knew that Paul Charlton in Arizona was the number one most productive United States attorney in the country. He knew I was number four and that Carol Lamb from San Diego was number seven. And yet, he told an untruth in front of the Congress. Gonzalez, who'd been teetering on the brink of resignation, stepped down in August, as did Karl Rove, the alleged brain of the president. And I have a chapter in my book, which I hope you'll buy, by the way. I mean, this is a book signing in addition to a speech. But I have a chapter called All Roads Lead to Rove. And I think by the time this is over and by the time the Wilson play matter is concluded, Rove may end up serving some time. Because one of the things, the principle that's involved here is everybody is subject to the law. It doesn't matter where you work. It doesn't matter what's after your name. If you break the law, there's a consequence. And he will find out, I hope, the hard way. And there are lots of other people who resigned I don't have time to mention. My fired colleagues and I were able to figure out we weren't alone within a couple of weeks of our ill-fated December 2006 phone calls. We remained in constant email and phone contact. We even had phone conferences. The media kept the full court press on, stories exploding like popcorn during the spring and summer of last year. I was even interviewed by Danish and Swedish television. And I asked them, they came to our house, and I said, why is this a big deal in Scandinavia? And they said, oh, you don't understand. The world is watching. We watch what happens in America. Whether you like it or not, you're the leader. So some days, like Gonzalez's resignation, I did more than 20 interviews, more than I'd ever done in my 5.5 years as United States Attorney for New Mexico. The local media used to think I was shy and reticent and aloof. Not anymore. And then in March of this year, the House of Representatives filed a lawsuit against former White House counsel Harriet Myers and current White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolton. The suit was about them not showing up to testify about our firing. And please understand, my book is not just about my firing. It's a personal account, how a firing affects a family. I have 4 daughters in Albuquerque. But it also goes into the stories of my colleagues, Bud Cummings in Arkansas, and Paul Charlton in Arizona, Carol Lamb in San Diego, and Margaret Chiara in the Western District of Michigan, Paul, and Diane Bogdan in Las Vegas. Not New Mexico, Las Vegas, Nevada, and John McKay in Seattle. You get to read their story of what happened, you know, to them. And I was advised by White House counsel, this is the first time in U.S. history this type of suit had ever been filed by Congress. My wife Cindy, when she was standing behind me as I testified in front of the Senate, said, when we all stood up and raised our right hand, the hairs on the back of her neck stood up. And she thought, history is being made here. I thought at the time, wow, I was just scared. I didn't have the hair stand up. But I think she could be on to something. Myers and Bolton claimed executive privilege. This matter may end up being heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. The lead case, listen to this, folks. If you're dozing off, listen to this. I'm almost done. The lead case in executive privilege is United States versus Nixon, 1974. You remember what was going on back then? Well, I'm writing an article for Slate.com, which had come out in a week or two on executive privilege, and I talk about the ghosts of Watergate haunting this case. So you might want to read it. But it's about the Nixon administration claiming this incredibly expansive view of executive privilege. And what the Supreme Court said is, yes, it exists, but it's a limited privilege. And what the present administration is saying is, we're going to expand it out not only to people that didn't give the president any advice, because he's gone on record saying he had nothing to do with our firing. But it also even goes out to people outside the government, which, in my view, is absolutely unfounded. And I hope the court agrees. So America stands for lots of good things. Among those is a fair criminal justice system, one free from political interference. I say that as somebody that was born a U.S. citizen in Latin America, who have lots of family members down there, who lived in Latin America for 8 years, and in lots of countries, folks, the rule of law is not respected. In America, it is. I have no regrets, and I appreciate the support of many of you in this audience. In particular, I have to recognize my wife, Cindy, who has been a warrior standing to my right and to my left during this past 18 months. So I thank you for your prayers, your emails, your kind support. When you get the book, I'd suggest you look at the appendices first, because they talk about a bipartisan statement that the National Association of Former U.S. Attorneys issued to then Attorney General Gonzalez. These are both Democrat and Republican former U.S. attorneys that state what happened was wrong, and they lay it out. Please read that first. There have been some changes made by the Justice Department. Previously, there were hundreds of permissible contacts between the White House and Justice Department personnel. So, for example, a low-level staffer could call and find out about a pending investigation. Now there are only four. Only four contacts are permissible. White House counsel, his deputy, the Attorney General, and his deputy. That's it. That's a good step in the right direction. And I talked to a sitting U.S. attorney just a few days ago who said, Dave, what you have to understand is the entire U.S. attorney community supports what you and your colleagues did. We understand what's at stake here. And I had a meeting in Washington with a currently serving insider in the Justice Department. He said the same thing. So finally, remember, a fair and impartial justice system is what America stands for. Let's never change that. I thank you for your attention, and I really look forward to your questions. Thank you very much, folks.
You're listening to David Iglesias, former United States Attorney, who will be speaking this Friday, September 12th at 7 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the College of Santa Fe campus. David Iglesias, I wanted to ask you, first of all, to what extent is U.S. Attorney a political appointment and a non-political appointment? As you point out in your book, many presidents take out all the sitting U.S. attorneys and put in new ones of their own party, and you're one of that batch.
Right. We are political appointees. We're appointed to four-year terms. But once we're in office, like federal judges, we're expected to stay out of politics. In fact, Ashcroft told me and every incoming U.S. attorney in the summer of 2001, politics stay outside the door. And we took that advice very much to heart. So we come in through the political process. I mean, I ran for office 10 years ago. But once in office, evidence and the law, that's it.
How do you decide what cases to take on? And, of course, this is an issue that became very important in the firings of you and the other U.S. attorneys.
It's up to the prosecutor to decide based on the input that he gets or she gets from the assistants who are career people. These are people that serve in many cases for 20 or 30 years. And based on their experience, they make recommendations. It's up to the U.S. attorney to decide, is this the kind of case that we want to take? In a district like New Mexico, that is a very, very busy district, we really go for the bigger cases, and we work closely with the state DAs, the state prosecutors, and then they get to work on other cases that may overlap. But it's a judgment call. I mean, there's no quick book recipe to figure out which cases we should take.
So tell us the story, because I don't think you told about it in your speech, of the phone calls you got from the New Mexico congressional delegation.
The infamous phone calls. I've been meaning to ask Joe if he and Heather are related in any way. But I think probably not. This, in a very strange way, the book kind of pivots on three phone calls. The book opens up with a phone call that I got on December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. Ironically, I was coming back from some Reserve Navy duty when I got the phone call from Mike Battle, the director of the Executive Office of U.S. Attorneys in Washington.
Now, this is 2006.
This is 2006, telling me it was time to pack my bags and, you know, look for another job. So I thought, wow, you know, Merry Christmas to you too, Mike. But actually, he's a friend, and I figured he was just the messenger. But the real phone calls, the ones that really kind of set the stage, were in October. One was from Heather Wilson, soon to be the former congresswoman. Of the first district, and wanting to know about sealed indictments. I'd just shown up in Washington for a conference, and she was snooping around. She told me she'd heard on the campaign trail about alleged sealed indictments, and she wanted me to talk about it. Well, if any of you have ever worked for Los Alamos or Sandia, this would be similar to you working on a classified project, and a member of Congress calls up and says, hey, tell me about that project Looking Glass. You're going to say, I can't talk about that. It's very similar to that. She wanted to find out about prohibited information that I couldn't share with her without losing my job. Now, it turns out I lost my job anyway. And she was not very happy with the answer. About 2 weeks later, in late October, I get a second call from Senator Pete Domenici. Now, you have to understand, and my book goes into this, he'd been my mentor. When I ran for office, he helped me raise money. He gave me a staffer to help out. I mean, I looked up to him, but he was a lot more pointed. His conversation didn't even have any chit-chat like mine with Heather. And he said, look, you know, I want to find out about these alleged corruption matters, cases you've been reading about in the media. Are they going to get filed before November? And I thought, look, I'm not a poli-sci major, but I know what happens in November. And remember, for those of you from New Mexico, Heather Wilson was behind in the polls in mid-October when she called. She was desperate for any bit of information she could have used against her opponent, Patsy Madrid. And I'm convinced she picked up the phone and said, Pete, I talked to Iglesias, he wouldn't say anything. What can he do? And I'm sure Pete says, well, you know, hey, he owes his job to me, and I'll squeeze the information out of him. So I just told him about as much as I could without getting myself in trouble, and I just said, well, I didn't think so. And then he said, I'm very sorry to hear that, and he hung up on me. You know, as parents, you know, we always teach our kids, you don't hang up on people. And the senator found out the hard way bad things happen when you hang up on people. So he hung up on me, and I my wife Cindy was standing 5 feet away. I was at home. It was a weekend, and I'd never received any phone call from any member of Congress at home about anything until that one phone call. And that set the chain reaction into motion.
So where those phone calls are concerned, what specifically were they looking for, and what was the political motivation for it?
They were looking for privileged, confidential information about the Bernalillo County Courthouse case involving former state senator Manny Aragon, who was indicted 3 weeks after I left. And the political corruption investigations and prosecutions are very, very dangerous for any prosecutor, because you'll always be accused of engaging in a political witch hunt or a political prosecution, regardless of the evidence. So that's what they were snooping around about, and I didn't give them what they wanted. I didn't rush the indictment. I very much felt like when the senator called me, he wanted it filed right away, so that would aid Heather. Because here, if you can't connect those dots, what she would have done with, had I given her the information, she would have used that as an attack piece against Patsy, saying Patsy hasn't done anything in 8 years, no corruption investigations. The feds are going to embark on another corruption case. Because remember the Vigil matter and Michael Montoya? Well, we had prosecuted those cases. So she would have used that as another talking point. And, you know, U.S. attorneys aren't talking points. We do serious things. We put people behind bars. And, you know, what she asked for was completely beyond the pale. And I'm glad she finally paid a consequence, because I'm not sure the House Ethics Committee is going to end up doing anything.
What was the common thread between you and the other fired U.S. attorneys? And what was the process of piecing this together that the seven of you went through?
Most of us were engaged in high-level political corruption investigations. Paul Charlton was investigating Rick Renzi, conservative Republican member of Congress. And his chief of staff, or pardon me, his press officer called Charlton's press officer and said, is my boss being investigated? Can't comment on that. That's like calling a CIA operative and say, tell me what's in your dossier. We can't talk about it. Carol Lamb had just convicted Randy Duke Cunningham, conservative Republican member of Congress in San Diego. And she was, and this is the bizarro world part of this. She was just investigating Dusty Fago, who used to work at the same agency as Valerie here. He was a number three guy, a political appointee, a Republican. And within 24 hours of Carol emailing Maine Justice in Washington and saying, I'm going to execute the search warrant, Kyle Sampson, the chief of staff to Gonzalez, says, we have a problem with Carol Lamb. And the problem was she was being honest and was doing her job, and she was taken out. John McKay was criticized roundly by the right wing of the party in Washington State for not getting involved in a gubernatorial recount. If you remember, three recounts, the first two went to the Republican, the last went to the Democrat. She won by 140 some odd votes, I want to say. And they were furious with McKay for not indicting anybody. And I asked John about it. It's in the book. And he said, I didn't have the evidence. Because remember, when you accuse somebody of a crime, you need this pesky little thing called evidence. And you have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a really high standard. So corruption, voter fraud, Todd Graves, the U.S. attorney from Kansas City, Missouri. He refused to indict matters into alleged voter fraud. And that's why the Republicans were mad at me initially. Is, remember back in 04, New Mexicans, there was all this stuff about voter fraud? Well, I investigated it. And it wasn't just me. It was the FBI local office. It was the Maine Justice. It was the state police. It was the county clerk. And the same problem. We couldn't prove any case, so I'm not going to authorize a bogus case. And they just could never understand why I wouldn't file a politically based prosecution. Todd Graves had the same thing happen to him. So those are the common threats. Now, with Dan Bogdan, I have no idea why he was let go. I think probably because Kyle Sampson, and I say this in the book, this is speculation on my part, okay? Sampson wanted the U.S. attorney job in Utah, didn't get it, so the next best thing was Las Vegas. I think it was that simple.
So if you look at the big picture, the people who were fired either weren't protecting Republicans or weren't going after Democrats or weren't prosecuting voter issues that would help Republicans.
That's my take, and then that's what I essentially state in my book.
The firings didn't take into account that U.S. attorneys were what you called the legal world's equivalent of gladiators. They didn't stop to think that they're dealing with prosecutors. If you fire 7 prosecutors, they're not just going to sort of slip quietly into the night. So
okay.
when you look back on it, to what extent do you feel that our system of checks and balances worked and didn't work as the whole situation played out on the national stage?
I'll answer that, but I want to go back to my wife's favorite movie, Gladiator. You've all seen it with Russell Crowe, Maximus. They cut 7 Maximuses loose and then wondered why we went back in the Coliseum and started killing them. It worked in a delayed fashion. It didn't work right away. You know, this is unprecedented, and no one at Maine Justice, even people that have been there 30 and 40 years, have told me they've never seen anything like this. So if anybody tells you, oh, political appointees, bunch of crybabies, you know, say no, this has never happened. The checks and balances came in when, with a Senate and House controlled by the Democrats, remember, we believe in checks and balances in this country, exercise oversight for the first time in 6 years. Had this happened a year or two before, the scandal would have never hit, because my party would not have exercised oversight. So I want to thank you, Democrats, for supporting your folks.
You talked a moment ago in your talk about executive privilege. What is it? Where are the actual rules written down about it? How is it interpreted?
Executive privilege is something that even President Washington wrestled with. He was requested to provide some treaty information by the House of Representatives. He talked to his legal counsel, who said, if you look at the Constitution, it says that the Senate has treaty-making powers along with you. So he gave the information to the Senate, not the House, claiming privilege. And he didn't use that exact word, but you can go back that far. Those of you that are old enough to remember the Hiss-Chambers matter back in the Truman administration, Truman ordered his officials to not testify about that matter, claimed on executive privilege. But what really broke it loose, and having a court recognize it at the Supreme Court level, was a Nixon case. When Leon Jaworski, learned about these covert tapes that Nixon had made, I'm sure we remember that, and the president said, I don't have to produce that. It's privileged communications amongst my advisors and me. Well, the Supreme Court disagreed. And this is kind of where we're at, because what the president is saying now is that Bolton and Myers and Rove don't have to testify, even though he's admitted he didn't receive any information about them, about us. So it's extended to advice amongst them. And the Nixon case doesn't stand for that.
You're listening to David Iglesias, former United States attorney, who will be speaking this Friday, September 12th at 7 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the College of Santa Fe campus.
You wrote in your book, the deepest implications of the disaster at Maine Justice are not of partisan politics, nor are they of transient liberal or conservative issues. Rather, at their molecular core, they are issues of illegality and unconstitutionality. So, you're a prosecutor. Whom would you prosecute, and for what illegal and unconstitutional acts?
For a scholarly discussion, read John McKay's. You can get this on the internet. John McKay, the former attorney from Seattle, wrote a piece in the Seattle Law Review called Trainwreck at Main Justice. And what John writes, and I agree with this, is the once the Inspector General's report is completed, a special prosecutor be appointed, somebody with tremendous respect, somebody who's not perceived as partisan, and have him or her investigate and then, if necessary, indict. But, I mean, I still see Rove's fingerprints all over this. Gonzalez may have, I think, in my view, perjured himself in front of the House and Senate when he testified. McNulty may have also. So those are possible charges. But again, it's got to be done by an independent counsel.
What do you see as the role of the next administration and Congress in, well, first of all, bringing people to justice and also undoing the damage that's been done in all three branches of government?
Well, they've got to clean up the House. There's been some progress at Main Justice. I mean, let's be honest. There are only a handful of departments where I think everybody in this room would agree politics should never play a part. Department of Defense, Department of State, Department of Justice. And the independent agency of CIA. I mean, you know, you don't want to have the spying, the surveillance apparatus of this country compromised like it was in Valerie's case. So there's a lot of house cleaning to do, and I'm glad there's been some progress, but the progress won't be complete until there's a completely new administration.
Can I just broaden that a little bit? In my view, and I've articulated this to every campaign that has talked to me, and most of them have, except in John McCain's, that the Constitution demands that we investigate this administration for possible crimes against the Constitution. And it would be a terrible mistake after they go out of office not to have full investigations into their activities and a whole host of issues related to justice and related to national security, and let the chips fall where they may. Rule of law and the Constitution of our great country require that.
This is a question for all three of you. I mean, I'm really interested in the picture that is painted in David Iglesias' book. It's a picture of an administration that is doing things like these firings and many other things for political motivations, but it's not the political motivation of furthering a party agenda like national security or certain moral issues or whatever. The agenda seems to be power for its own sake, the permanent Republican hegemony. And there are cases like Valerie Plame, who's here on stage with us, and many other cases like the firings of the U.S. attorneys, where the actions actually go against the professed goals of the party, like national security. And I was wondering if each of you could talk about in ways in which this administration's actions has actually undermined the party's own political agendas.
Well, I think I may have actually said this in the Lenzik last time I was here. I think that this is a band of radicals who have taken over the Republican Party and are exploiting the brand of the Republican Party for their own radical ends, which are power for the sake of power, power to reward your friends and punish your enemies, and the hell with everything else. Because if, in fact, you're a true Republican, how can you support this administration? If you're a true Republican, you believe in such concepts as fiscal responsibility. And this administration has driven us trillions of dollars into debt. If you're a true Republican, you believe in such things as limited size of the federal government. And you need to look only at the national security proliferation through Homeland Security and Directorate of National Intelligence, et cetera, to see the extent to which they have consolidated power in Washington. And if you're a true Republican, you believe that there really ought to be an upper limit to how much time the federal government spends peeking in your bedroom window. How can you then support an administration that politicizes the most human, the most personal of human tragedies and Terry Schiavo, not to mention everything else that they do with warrantless wiretapping, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that these guys, frankly, operate so far outside the parameters of acceptable American political behavior that, as Richard Clark said just the other night, they should not be permitted back into polite society. Other than that, I hold very few strong views.
What deeply troubles me, and I will stick to my knitting on this question, and by that I mean I will speak to the politicization of our intelligence community. Everyone wants to believe, every American, no matter what your political stripe is, you want to believe that whatever intelligence lands on the president's desk is devoid of ideological taint or political bias. It should just be just the facts, right? That's what you want to believe. But we have seen, particularly over these 8 years, an acceleration of politics injected into it. You see it in so many different ways. Right now you have about 60, I just finished a book about this from Tim Sherrock, it was excellent, about 60 or 70% of our intelligence functions are outsourced. It's like Blackwater, they're contractors. And this, I mean, conversation for another time, but that is as a result of, you know, favors going, you know, the sort of the revolving door. And let me tell you, what the politicization of intelligence does, it destroys morale, it undermines the product. And in the contractor's case, when you can imagine what that does, if you have 60% of your intelligence product being brought in by contractors, then the actual entity, you know, the institutional knowledge is fading away to nothing. You look across at the heads of the various intelligence entities, many of them are in uniform. Right? For instance, General Michael Hayden at the CIA. I don't have a problem with uniforms per se. I'm the daughter of an Air Force colonel. But when that is your only perspective and that's the only sort of viewpoint that you are getting, I like the saying that, you know, when the only tool in your toolbox is a hammer, every problem starts to look like a nail. So that's a problem, and then that is directly result. And, of course, you have, as you spoke about, Congress' complete lack of oversight. They have completely abdicated their responsibilities. So I feel that this, I'm deeply troubled by this. I know my former colleagues are as well, and I hope that the next administration that comes in puts this right.
I was wondering, Joe Wilson, if you could talk more about the power for its own sake, modus operandi, and how that plays out on the international stage.
Well, I think clearly these guys have sacrificed some of our broader national security interests in the interests of having power, maintaining power, and continuing power. At the end of the day, if you take a look at this war in Iraq, and you go back and you look at what President Bush said when he was governor, when he said, a war president is a great president, and if there's an opportunity, I will seize it. And that's in his biography that was never written, but the guy who did the biography has talked about that. The opportunity presented itself, and these guys saw it as a way of, one, being a great president, and two, implementing Karl Rove's vision of a permanent Republican majority. A quick, easy war like Grenada, and suddenly they get reelected. It didn't turn out that way. They thought, as Rupert Murdoch said, they'd end up with $20 a barrel oil. It's now 140 or something like that. They also thought that they might be able to actually control the rate of development in India and China by controlling the spigots. King Abdullah, when he came to power in Saudi Arabia, the first trip he made was not to the United States, but it was to Beijing. And for every contract they signed with the United States, they signed 17 with the Chinese now. It didn't work out real well for them. The political and moral authority and international leadership capacity of this great country of ours has been absolutely destroyed. But they were able to ride it to re-election in 2004. So, you know, to a certain extent, and they, you know, the argument was you don't change commander-in-chiefs in the middle of a stream. So hopefully we will have learned. But my view of this is that they have mastered the propaganda machine. And clearly, as you saw, if you saw the New York Times article about the retired generals that they used to propagandize Americans, including Paul Vallely, who one time accused me of having said to his wife in a green room that my wife worked for the CIA, which wasn't true. But that's the sort of disinformation that they were laying on the American people. So hopefully now, over the last several years, the people like Valerie and myself and David Iglesias and Richard Clark and a few others who have stood up and said enough's enough. We'll be able to turn, roll this back. But, it has been very clear that, they have taken national security and used it as a tool for the perpetuation of their place in power.
So I thought we could talk for a few minutes about the media. We're here with KSFR and very proud to be working in independent media, because independent media are really the way that people find out what's going on without corporate media bias. But we're in a very strange situation right now where Scott McClellan, who's written a new book, which is called What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception, he's being attacked in the media while Karl Rove is being rewarded by being a pundit. Is this fixable?
Well, over the last week or so, I've had a number of people tell me that David Iglesias, who was on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, and I thought to myself, who would have thought that... So we've come a long way, baby. I've said this repeatedly, that that the idea that the Wall Street Journal and Fox News would put this lying traitor Karl Rove on their payroll is absolutely beyond me. There used to be a time in this country where you would shun traitors, and now they're rewarded in the right-wing media, which tells you a lot about this particular brand of right-wing media. And I was in an exchange of emails with the Washington Post reporter just a couple of days ago, because he was whining that I asked a question in an interview, where was he when it counted in the run-up to the war? I think the mainstream media has utterly failed in their responsibilities to the public. Dan Rather gave a great speech at a conference, I think, in Washington over the weekend. I'm sure you can find it on YouTube.
It was in Minnesota.
Minnesota, wherever it was. It was a great speech on the failure of mainstream media. The good news, I think, is that in America, when you're not happy with the service you're getting, competition arises. And you've seen that through the independent media, which I think I don't know what your figures look like, but they can't be going down, because there's nothing else to... Nothing we're seeing on the networks or even on cable news. The blogosphere has grown up and provided a lot of independent analysis. I read every day from a dozen news sources. And I only glance at the Times and the Post just so I can criticize them. I read from the newspapers all over the world. And frankly, I'm much happier not having to read David Broder or George Will or David Brooks or Bill Kristol, the two neoconservatives they put on the editorial page. There was a time in the media where you actually had to earn your chops before they would give you a column. Now you just have to be an ideologue. And I don't think we're served that well by a return in the mainstream media to really what is essentially yellow journalism.
With regard to Scott McClellan's book, I have a couple observations. First of all, I had the luxury of time and distance, and I have to say, when this all sort of blew up, I thought, thank goodness it's Scott and not me. So I had a little bit of remove to observe, and one thing was apparent was that all the White House supporters and apologists and so forth, did not at any point go after the substance of his revelations or allegations. They just sought to discredit him. And, you know, I'm in 24 hours into the beginning of the news cycle thinking, how long will it take before we hear rehab or drugs or little girls or little boys or, you know, take your pick? And that did, in fact, come out in the fullness of time of, you know, this is just not the Scott that I knew. But then within the next 24-hour news cycle, the mainstream media were questioning themselves in sort of response to some of his allegations. They would show clips at Scott at the podium at the White House, and they'd be throwing questions up. And, some people were saying, well, the media was taking, umbrage that they were being criticized by Scott and other commentators that they hadn't asked the right questions or enough of the questions. And all you see is in there, they're in the White House press room. Well, you know, they think that because they said, is that true about what the president said about WMD, Scott? That's really investigative reporting. That's getting out there. You know, that you could tell that various well-known commentators were offended that they had been criticized, that they did not somehow miss the good question or didn't. And what Joe and I have said all along in pertaining to our particular story of the leak and so forth is that they just sort of took what was spoon-fed to them. We believe that. And that's applicable both to the war, to our case, to many other things. I'm making sweeping generalizations, but that's what they are. That their reluctance to find the analysis, to find another story, to find someone else who maybe counters what the administration says.
High-paid stenographers. I asked this Washington Post journalist who was bitching at me for having used his name, Tom Ricks. I said, Tom, send me some of the articles that you wrote in the run-up to the war where you actually weighed the facts, where you tested the evidence, where you got a source that wasn't official, where Scott Ritter would be a good one to have checked with, Brent Scowcroft, Joe Wilson, somebody who had actually been on the ground in Baghdad. Send me this. Let me know what you actually did when it counted. And I haven't heard back from him yet. High-paid stenographers in the rush to war.
And I just want to add about the media. If you look at my acknowledgments in my book, I acknowledge lots of media. But I'll say one thing. When you talk to the mainstream media, you have about 5 or 6 minutes to get your message across. And sometimes really complicated issues, intelligence, for example, criminal justice, for another example, it's hard to boil those down in little sound bites. It was nice to be on the Diane Rehm show for an hour and actually get to speak in complete sentences. C-SPAN, Washington Journal, same thing. I was on for half an hour, took calls from citizens from across the country. It's just nice to have the ability to sit down and actually have a conversation and not a compressed micro-interview. I'd like to acknowledge TPM Muckraker. Those of you, I can see there are some fans out there. TPM stands for Talking Points Memo. So if you've never been on the website, just go to Google or your favorite search engine, type in Talking Points Memo, and you can point it. It's wonderful. It has links to original documents, to testimony on Capitol Hill, and lots of scandals from throughout the country are listed on TPM Muckraker, and I specifically thank them because they're the first ones that really kind of put the pieces of the puzzle together in the media, and they've been really staunch backers of the fired U.S. attorneys.
You've been listening to David Iglesias, Joe Wilson, and Valerie Plame Wilson at the Lensic on June 9th of this year. David Iglesias will be speaking this Friday, September 12th at 7 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe in a lecture titled Stepping Across the Party Line. The lecture is free, and it's the first of this year's Beyond the Lecture series, and this year's theme is Rebels, Reformers, and Revolutionaries. For more information, you can call 473-6282 or on the web, go to csf.edu. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.